From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, it's been a summer marked by violence in Milwaukee. Police Chief Edward Flynn reflects on what he sees happening here. Later, possible expansions of Wisconsin's Amtrak routes.
It's hard to think of a passenger train success story coming out of Wisconsin, but the fact is, the Hiawatha service that Amtrak runs now is one of the top 10 rail corridors in the United States. And so, really, the state wants to build on that success.
And actor Eric Estrada on why he thinks audiences still remember Chips fondly.
They sat with the mom and dads and their brothers and sisters and you know, relatives, and they remember warm, fuzzy, cozy times. And that affects them, too. So that's one of the lasting things about it as well.
Lake Effect is next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. After years of relative calm, violent crime has seen a dramatic uptick in Milwaukee this summer. Both murders and non-fatal shootings have alarmed residents, mobilized police, and spurred rhetoric by politicians on all sides. Leaders such as Mayor Barrett have called for funding to put more officers on the streets, a request that has been met with some debate from state lawmakers. And earlier this week, Barrett and Police Chief Edward Flynn were in Washington to speak with top federal officials, including President Obama, about the issue of youth violence. Chief Flynn is with us in the studio now to talk about a challenging summer. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
You and other chiefs of police and mayors, I believe this week, met with the Attorney General of the United States to talk about youth violence. What was the message you sought to bring, and what was it that you've heard and you did hear in that meeting?
Well, it was very interesting. The White House and the Attorney General both invited about 15 mayors and their police chiefs to a series of meetings. The mayors met with the president, police chiefs got lunch and then came back. And we had an opportunity to sit down with the attorney general with some of the mayors in attendance. The purpose of the meeting from the attorney general's point of view was literally to pick our brains, that the cities that were identified to come to the meeting were all cities that have violence issues. You know, we were not there with, you know, San Jose and Sunnyvale, California. We were there with Philadelphia and with Baltimore and with Memphis and with Minneapolis and with St. Louis and similarly situated cities. And the discussion was really what the dynamics, what's changed, who's affected. It was a different sort of meeting than I'm used to when I meet with federal officials. Usually when I have one of those meetings, they invite us there allegedly to hear from us and then give us a lecture about something they want to do. There was no lecture at the end of this. It was very much how might we be of assistance in a thoughtful, targeted way. And so a number of the mayors, a number of the police chiefs identified what is a common issue across the urban centers of America, that is youth violence, not specifically juveniles as legislatively defined, but youth violence between the ages of 15 and 30, quite honestly, firearms related and highly concentrated in the African-American community, primarily involving people with criminal histories. This is not unique to Milwaukee. And the Philadelphia mayor, Mayor Nutter, made a very strong statement about the impact that this violence committed by and against African-Americans in Central City is having a major drag on the economic prospects of those folks and on the city of Philadelphia generally. And he was strongly seconded by the mayor of New Orleans, who basically said he called it catastrophic, the level of casualties among young black men in central cities. And so that certainly drove a part of the discussion. And one of the points I was there to make was that there's an awful lot of talk about disparity as the results of police tactics, such as field interviews or car stops or arrests for felony crimes. The point is these disparities exactly mirror the grotesque disparity in victimization experienced by poor communities of color in the central cities of the United States. And that's certainly something the mayors of those cities all strongly agreed about. So, you know, we had a good discussion, and the sense I got was the Justice Department, which really has no money right now, nobody does, for any of the kind of grant programs that we had perhaps in prior years, is interested in targeted investments in best practices application. In other words, can they help us identify strategies that have been effective long term? I mean, all the departments there know the blocking and tackling of police work. But are there longer term anti-violence strategies that research supports are effective over a longer period of time, and then trying to replicate them in some of the cities that were there? So there was some cautious optimism that in this case, the Justice Department was really trying to be useful beyond the arrest, you know, beyond the investigation, and seeing if they could support. Because, I mean, the bottom line is you drive down crime in the central cities, you drive down the crime in the United States. I mean, the crime rate in the United States is always driven by the central cities. So if there's a significant decrease, I mean, in my first year here when we had a 30% decrease in homicides, that drove the state decrease because we had most of the state's homicides in the first place. So the thought is that an investment in a city such as Milwaukee and New Orleans and Philadelphia could have a significant benefit for national data.
Well, and so let me ask you this, because we have talked in the past about your policing philosophy and indeed about how violent crime has decreased in the past. The efforts that you've undertaken in the past, are they no longer working? Is something different about 2013 in the summer in Milwaukee than it has been in the previous 5-6 years here?
Well, you know, we've engaged, you know, very thoughtfully and very consistently in a community-based, problem-oriented, data-driven strategy that over the course of 5.5 years has had significant impact on the overall crime rate. You know, I'm the first one to admit and draw the community's attention to the fact that we've had a terrible 2 months and I'm bringing a spotlight to it. This does not mean the police department should suddenly panic and abandon tactics that have been working for 5.5 years. By every metric, crime is down. Now, I know there's folks out there who want to fuss and fume about, you know, the series of articles in the newspaper a couple of years ago. But, you know, our data has been audited several different times. It's reliable. In the aggregate, we've had a 30% decrease in overall crime in the last 5.5 years. And that figure has been, you know, tossed about frequently and looked at. We're comfortable with the accuracy of our findings, but been incremental, you know. And this year, at the mid-year point, we had 35 homicides, which would have put us on pace to have a record low number of homicides. I mean, the record low was 72 my first year. And it looked like we were going to do even less than that. I mean, it was really – we were fingers crossed. Don't talk about the no-hitter. Things are going well. Well, you know, it's now 7 weeks after the six-month data come out, and we've had 30 homicides in 7 weeks. I mean, it's the most violent period of time in 5.5 years. There's no unitary explanation for it. We've had a wide variety of homicides. It's not like I can say this gang is fighting this gang. No, we've had – domestic homicides, child abuse homicides, you know, random explosion of road rage homicides, bar fight homicides, every kind of homicide we could have. And we've also had a significant uptick in the number of non-fatal shootings. Mid-year this year, we were well below last year's pace. In the last 2 months, we've basically had our entire increase. I mean, so far this year, we've had 20 more non-fatal shootings than we did last year at this time, which are hardly numbers to panic about. But the fact is they've been extraordinarily concentrated in the last 2 months. So the entire year's increase and then some has happened in just a two-month period.
Now, and I assume as a police department, it does not behoove you to say, well, hey, these statistics are an anomaly. You have to react to them.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, in any field endeavor, you are going to have periods of intense activity. I don't care if you work in a hospital and you do preventive medicine and then all of a sudden a bunch of people get sick. Doesn't mean, you know, your preventive medicine doesn't work. It means a bunch of people got sick. And what we've got to be able to do here is continue to work on the three aspects of what our job is. We focus on prevention. When we don't prevent, we need to solve as rapidly as we can. We're still batting over 70% clearance rates for our homicides. And then we have to continue to make sure that we don't end up in retaliatory cycles of violence. And, you know, come to me right now, the spikes are robberies and shootings. And homicide, of course, is up, and that's a component of our increase in shootings. Burglaries are down compared to last year. Car thefts are down compared to last year. Larcenies are down compared to last year. But we've certainly had this spike. We're investing resources in it. Our officers are around the ball. I mean, we made 2,500 arrests just in the month of July. We've made another 2,500 arrests so far in August. So that's 5,000 arrests in 2 months. I mean, this police department is out there around the ball interfacing with those with whom we must interface. But it's undeniable that there's an extraordinary number of guns out there. We've taken hundreds of guns off the street just in 7 weeks. The undeniable fact is we are facing violent individuals who are heavily armed.
5,000 arrests in 2 months. The mayor has called for funding for more officers on the street. The assembly speaker has talked about what he calls errors in policing. What is your take on how manpower has been deployed and his claim that that there have been errors?
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to have the conversation with the speaker over the phone. I think he'd like to take a mulligan on that one, because as we had the conversation, he's going to come here, as a matter of fact, and we're going to show him the level of analysis we do, the thoughtfulness of our deployments, and the overall effect of our strategies. And in fact, by the time I spoke to him, which was after the notorious comment, but also subsequent to his meeting with some of our aldermen, he had a somewhat different perspective already. So, you know, I think sometimes people make statements based on what other people have told them. And when you're in public life, there's a lot of people out there that want to spin you one way or the other. I think we have the basis perhaps for some useful conversations. I mean, Milwaukee needs the state legislature right now. You know, Milwaukee clearly is an essential part of the state of Wisconsin. This is our legislature too. It's our governor too. These are Wisconsin residents in this city that are facing these situations. And so, you know, we've made what I think are reasonable requests. It was the Joint Committee on Finance, which is made up of the Senate and the House, that recommended that the city get $445,000 of community policing money. The governor excised it at a time when he felt pressure to balance the budget. Well, the budget's balanced now, okay? I think maybe it's appropriate to revisit that. I know there's some talk about, well, other cities will have it too. Well, believe me, if there's any other cities out there in Wisconsin right now with 65 homicides, I'm happy to share the money. I'll split it with them, okay? But I don't think you're going to get those requests from anybody else, because nobody else is facing the vortex of social and crime problems that this city has to confront. And I think reasonable people can say that's nobody's fault. There's social and historical reasons why Milwaukee is facing the challenges that it is. Let's, you know, step away from the talking points and see if we can come together and solve problems that are afflicting some of Wisconsin's residents.
Well, and in the middle of all this, some, including you, have called for new mandatory minimum sentences for firearm violations. Why do you think that would make a difference?
Well, you know, I need to make a disclaimer up front. A lot of attention has been brought to the issue of disparity in sentencing around drugs, and I thoroughly understand that concern. And as far as I'm concerned, that should be part of any discussion about mandatory sentences. I think we're past the point of recognizing that mandatory sentences for drug possession are not part of a successful strategy dealing with the public health issues resolved around drugs. And so let us revisit them, because it is absurd. There's no mandatory sentence for being a dangerous criminal with a gun, but there is one for being in possession of drugs. And so, you know, by all means, let us have that conversation. And most chiefs I know agree that it's time to revisit that. Certainly the large city chiefs do. Having said that, however, many people don't realize that a big part of the New York City miracle of the late 1990s in drastically reducing homicides. Remember, they had 2,000 homicides in 1992, and that number now is 400, okay? And overwhelmingly, like every other city, their homicides were concentrated among poor people of color, dramatically reduced it. Yes, they increased the size of the department by a third. Yes, they started to manage it effectively with data. But the third part of that, that's the third leg on that stool, was New York State passed a mandatory, if you're caught with illegally carrying a weapon, it's a 3-year sentence. And my friend Gary McCarthy, who's now superintendent of police in Chicago, was first deputy commissioner. He's the first one to say that made all the difference. And he's asked for that same law in Illinois, as a matter of fact. Because right now in Milwaukee, it is more dangerous for a career criminal to get caught without his gun than to get caught with it. All right, if he's caught without it by another felon, they're going to have a shootout. If he's caught with us by it, he's going to get a misdemeanor. Okay, we had our CompStat meeting today. We were talking about one of our career criminals who's been arrested 3 times since April in possession of a firearm. All right, that's clearly a man undeterred by the current statutes. And as a matter of fact, the last time he was arrested, he said, you know, I need to get my permit to carry. And the irony is right now he qualifies for a permit to carry. Because under our current state law, only convicted felons are forbidden from getting a gun permit, and we're having career drug dealers lawfully carrying guns on the streets of Milwaukee because their only convictions have been to misdemeanor pleas. And we have this guy who's been arrested 3 times illegally carrying, who's been at shooting scenes, who's well documented as part of the criminal community, saying, you know, I got to quit getting arrested for this. I should go get my concealed carry permit. And right now he would be successful in getting it. So the two asks are a minimum sentence, and please, can we not fashion a law that says career criminals may not get gun permits?
To a completely different topic before we wrap up, there are tens of thousands of Harley riders in town for the Labor Day weekend. What sorts of challenges do you see that bringing to your department, if any?
Well, you know, we're going to take a nice deep breath at the end of this summer and recollect the extraordinary work that the men and women of this police department have done. You know, in their spare time from fighting significant crime, we have policed successfully, you know, Juneteenth Day, Summerfest, the ethnic festivals, a couple of marathons, a triathlon, and, you know, and now we're having, you know, Harley Fest. There's going to be 250,000 people are going to be in this town to ride motorcycles. And yes, that has an impact on traffic congestion. Every year we get at least one fatality on a motorcycle. We're going to protect these folks who come from all over from getting their motorcycles stolen. We're going to be on the alert for them driving drunk or having problems in taverns because they've had too much to drink. We're going to be basically policing a city within a city while at the same time engaged in heavy-duty anti-crime work. So, yes, it'll add stress. It's part of being a world-class city, okay? We're a first-class big city, which means just like, you know, Chicago, we've got to have the capacity to police major crowd events and still keep the rest of the city safe, and we're committed to doing that.
Chief Flynn, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Edward Flynn is Chief of Police of the Milwaukee Police Department. A short break now, and when we return, is an expansion in the works for the Amtrak lines running through Wisconsin. We'll talk with a rail journalist about that possibility, and later we'll talk about televised police work with Eric Estrada, 30 years after CHIPS. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Scott Walker rose to the governor's seat in a campaign that pledged, among other things, to kill plans for high-speed rail in Wisconsin. The governor followed through with that promise, and his administration has slowed other improvements to the state's rail corridors. But passenger rail has grown in the state nevertheless. Monthly passenger records have been set recently on the Hiawatha Line, which runs between Milwaukee and Chicago, and the Empire Builder, which takes Milwaukee passengers to the Twin Cities and beyond as far as Seattle. And that news has sparked reports of possible expansions to both of those lines, expansions the state of Wisconsin is studying closely. Matt Van Haddam is senior editor at Trains Magazine, published by Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing. He talked with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about Amtrak's fortunes in Wisconsin.
It's hard to think of a passenger train success story coming out of Wisconsin, but the fact is the Hiawatha service that Amtrak runs now is one of the top 10 rail corridors in the United States. And so really the state wants to build on that success. And what's happening right now is the State Department of Transportation is funding 2 studies looking at expanding the passenger rail services in Wisconsin. One of those studies is called a service plan, and that's looking at adding 3 more trains a day each way between Chicago and Milwaukee, which would boost the service from the 7 round trips a day we have now to 10 round trips. And these 3 new round trips would be express trains. They would be skipping the intermediate stops at Sturtevant and Glenview, and they'd be going 90 miles an hour versus today's 79-mile-an-hour trains, and that would cut about 11 minutes off a ride from Milwaukee to Chicago. Now, 2 of these new trains would be Chicago to Milwaukee trains, but the 3rd would be a Chicago to Twin Cities train, and that gets us into the 2nd study, and that's the feasibility study looking at what it would take to add another train between Chicago and Minneapolis.
Well, first of all, with the Hiawatha line to Chicago, do they have to spend money for track upgrades to get the train up to 90 miles an hour?
They will have to spend money for that. That's part of a federal mandate that's going into place right now for a type of collision avoidance system. And this will have to be put on any line that has passenger trains and any line that has a certain amount of hazardous material freight. It's called positive train control. And basically, it's designed to allow a train to stop in a safe amount of time if a signal is overridden and make sure that the trains don't hit each other.
So it's all about signaling. It's not necessarily about right-of-ways. I know there was some construction on the track for a while.
There was. That was actually part of the money that had come with some of the high-speed rail funding we heard about a few years ago. They did build some new switches on the line in the Sturtevant area in a place called Truesdell. And what that did was it allowed one train to cross from one track to another. It gives you a bit more flexibility if you want a passenger train to get to the other track and go around a slower-moving freight train.
All right. Well, and speaking of money, it kind of caught me by surprise when I saw this article. It's only been a couple of years after the big battle over high-speed rail, so here this proposal comes. Is it going to get any more support now than the high-speed rail initiative did just years ago?
Well, those are almost two different things. I mean, the high-speed rail initiative is dead. That money actually has gone to places like Illinois, where you're now seeing trains running at 110 miles an hour. They used our money, and now they have the fastest passenger trains in the Midwest, and they'll be building on that. What the state is doing right now is funding some very preliminary studies for the Chicago-Milwaukee service and the Chicago-Twin Cities train. They're working with Illinois and Minnesota on these two. These are very early studies. They're not very costly to do, but they are important steps if you want to build out the service. So we know that the state will pay for these studies. We don't know what's going to happen down the road yet, but these studies are important if you want to get federal funding to help pay for the startup costs along with the state share. But if you look at what's going on, I mean, these studies, they're important. I mean, the ridership between Chicago and Milwaukee has doubled in the past 10 years. The trains are just about getting maxed out. You're at a six-car train that seats 420 people. Some of these trains are standing room only. We set another ridership record last year. The trains carry 830,000 people a year now. That's a huge amount. We actually rank sixth among rail corridors across the U.S. for ridership. Chicago-Milwaukee is in the top 10. Again, hard to believe, but people like this train and use it. And I think that what the state is looking at is saying, what do we do to keep this service viable?
Why not, if this doesn't happen, why can't they just turn maybe two of the trains of the seven that currently exist to the express trains? Why do they have to add them on to create express trains?
I think the way the trains run now, they're serving the market well. If you were going to start skipping stops, you would be losing some riders. And we know that the intermediate stations, especially the Milwaukee Airport, the ridership, that station has really helped the ridership. That's actually now, Amtrak tells me, the busiest unstaffed station on the entire system, meaning there's no agent there. There's a computer kiosk where you can buy a ticket, but it has more passengers than any other station like that. So keeping the intermediate stops is good. When you get closer to Chicago, you've got to deal with issues like all of the Metra commuter trains that run on there. So you will need some track upgrades. And you've still got freight. Canadian Pacific Railway owns the tracks. They run about 20 trains a day between Chicago and the Twin Cities.
Okay. Yeah, I think people forget that the tracks are all they're all pretty much privately owned, right? I don't know of any tracks
here
that are publicly owned.
The only line that's publicly owned around here is part of the Chicago to Detroit line that Amtrak owns a section of. Otherwise, you have to go to the Northeast, the Boston to Washington Northeast corridor that Amtrak owns.
When I asked about money, I was also getting at the symbolism of the train. I mean, the political arguments of the past few years, the trains have become a very polarized issue. And it doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with money if you look at some of the underlying arguments. So what I'm saying is there's still perhaps that the perception there that we shouldn't even be involved in trains, or government shouldn't be involved in trains. So is there more support now for a more measured approach to just increasing a line that is pretty popular?
From what I understand, that was one thing that Scott Walker even had said all along. He supported the Chicago to Milwaukee Hiawatha service, and he would support improvements to it. I mean, it's interesting when you talk about money. The state has been sponsoring the Hiawatha train since 1989, and what that means is the state pays the difference between the ticket revenue that comes in and the operating costs to run the train. That's what the state funds. And a few years ago, we found out that ticket prices covered about two-thirds of the Hiawatha service cost. So it was just that one-third left over that Wisconsin and Illinois would pay together. Wisconsin would pay 75%. Illinois would pay 25%. That's actually a better financial return than state costs for highways. The latest studies I've seen show that state revenues from gas taxes and tolls that they get cover only about a third of the state and local costs associated with maintaining highways. So Amtrak's Hiawatha is covering two-thirds of its operating costs with ticket prices alone. As transportation funding goes, that's a good financial deal for Wisconsin.
Well, we'll leave it on that semi-positive note then as far as the Hiawatha goes. What is the purpose of adding another train to the Minneapolis destination? That never even occurred to me that that would be even an option.
Well, Chicago to Minneapolis, that's been a natural travel corridor for over a century. I mean, you think back historically.
That's the original,
That's one of the original great rail lines. You had three railroads. They were competing for passengers between the two cities. They had some of the fastest stylized streamliner trains in the country. They were some of the best for daytime travel.
I think that was the original 400, if I'm not mistaken.
One of the railroads was Chicago Northwestern ran the 400. And the reason behind that number was it was a 400-mile trip that the train did in 400 minutes. So you're talking an average speed of 60 miles an hour. They were going through Wisconsin at 90 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour. And you had the Milwaukee Road Line that Amtrak still uses now, also doing 90 to 100 miles an hour. These are very fast, very nice trains.
Right, okay.
So that demand for travel never went away. It shifted to highways and airplanes as interstates got improved and jet travel came along. But I think we're seeing now, especially in the last decade, those options aren't as attractive as they once were for that kind of medium distance travel. And so that's part of the reasoning behind this new study of looking for a second train. Right now, the one train that we have goes from Chicago to Minneapolis-St. Paul, but then it continues on to Seattle. It's really a long-distance train, and if you're going to Chicago, you're waiting for that train. I mean, it's a day and a half out by the time it gets to Minneapolis-St. Paul. There could be delays along the way. There could be issues. So having another train there not only taps into a travel market, it gives you a bit more consistency of service and reliability.
So are there any more details on what they're proposing? Is it and this would only be a train that goes to, I think, a little bit beyond Minneapolis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it would actually go – the thinking right now is to have the train run from Chicago to the Twin Cities and then on to St. Cloud, Minnesota. And I think that's a recognition of how that Twin Cities metropolitan area has just grown beyond the city borders. The details of this, Amtrak is conducting what it calls a feasibility study for adding this second train between Chicago and the Twin Cities. Now, the funding for that is coming from Wisconsin and from Minnesota and also from the city of La Crosse. The total cost of that study is about $60,000. I mean, this isn't an idea that's been going on since 2011, adding a second train in that corridor. So this study will look at things like, you know, what do we need in terms of extra equipment, what track improvements or expansions will have to be done, any station work that might have to be done, and what the schedules might be. And we expect to see the results of this study probably in December of this year.
Now, are these studies going to look at ridership? And I want your opinion on that. Do you think that there are enough riders going between Chicago and Minneapolis and even St. Cloud to justify an additional train?
Oh, I think there are absolutely enough passengers that would go between those cities to justify another train. The Empire Builder right now, on many days, the seats are just about sold out. It's tough to get a seat. And part of that reason, too, now is the Empire Builder is going on into North Dakota. You have a lot of oil field workers who are coming in and out of North Dakota and using the train. they're taking up more seats now. So some of the short distance travel, you can't find a seat. The state did a study a couple of years ago and looked at how people use the Empire Builder in Wisconsin. And what it found was that 70% of the people that got on or off the Empire Builder in our state were using it simply for Chicago to Twin Cities travel. So that was the natural corridor, and that's a corridor that makes sense for more train service.
And any thoughts on whether this would also be high speed? Is that possible on that line?
You would need more track and signal upgrades. You could not run high speed there now. What's interesting is while all this is going on, Minnesota is also paying for its own study, what it calls an environmental impact statement, that would look at running 6 trains a day at 110 miles an hour on the Empire Builder route. So that would be a totally next level ramp up of that kind of train service in the corridor.
Now, they're talking about it for within their own state. Right.
They're talking about it from Chicago to the Twin Cities using the Empire Builder line we have now. You know, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about if we ran these trains, would we just skip Wisconsin? Wisconsin pulled out of some of the preliminary studies of the 110 mile an hour service. But after looking at 25 different routes, they determined that the Empire Builder route was the best one in terms of cost of startup being relatively reasonable and the number of riders it could attract. So that is the lane that will make the most sense.
And as far as the talks about high-speed rail, that it won't go to Madison anymore, for certainly. So is that still a possibility that the track between the Wisconsin portion could still be high-speed on the Empire Builder part?
That would be the possibility. That's what this study is looking at, what it would take, this environmental impact study. I mean, down the road, they're going to need Wisconsin's buy-in as more studies come up and you start looking at things like the construction costs. You're going to need the buy-in of Canadian Pacific Railway too. They own the tracks. They'll come back with a price tag for improving it. When they did this a couple of years ago as they were studying it, the price tag for running trains at 110 miles an hour was something like $2.3 billion. Now, that was 2011 money. That cost is only going to go up. Again, you can get federal money for these things, and part of the way you do that is doing all of these detailed studies.
Okay. Well, Matt Van Hattem, thank you for coming back on Lake Effect.
Well, Dan, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Matt Van Hattem is senior editor at Trains Magazine, published by Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing. He talked with Dan Harmon about possible expansions of Amtrak's Hiawatha and Empire Builder routes in Wisconsin. One last break, and then we'll speak with actor Eric Estrada. He gained fame more than 30 years ago as a motorcycle cop. He'll reflect on what Chips has meant to his life when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Harley-Davidson's 110th anniversary celebration has brought hundreds of thousands of people to Milwaukee. They're people from all walks of life linked by the community of motorcycling. Among them are some famous people, including at least one who is famous for riding a Harley on television. Actor Eric Estrada was one of the most recognizable faces on TV in the late 1970s and 80s. He played Ponch, Frank Poncherello, on the NBC series Chips, a cop show about motorcycle cops in the California Highway Patrol. The show was filled with car crashes amid beautiful Southern California scenes, and 30 years after the show left the air, Ponch is still the role people associate with Estrada, even after he had successful roles in several reality TV series and on some Spanish-language telenovelas. And so when we caught up with the actor, he was at the House of Harley, ready to take part in the festival's tribute to law enforcement. Eric Estrada, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Do you remember what your expectations were when you signed on to be on the show Chips?
No, I was just happy to have a steady job after 8 years of working, not working, auditioning, trying out, getting jobs, losing jobs. I was happy to have a steady job and praying that it'd go for long, many, many years. And it did, and it did quite a few things for me. It enabled me to get my mother off of welfare and out of the projects and – have her living the way I wanted her to live, and that's how she lives now. And she hasn't worked in 30-something years because I take care of everything. And it's given me notoriety and a popularity and recognition worldwide that I'm really grateful for. And I love being Ponch. I like being called Ponch. And I get to do a lot with that celebrity now. You know, I get to do a lot of good, like, for why I'm here in Milwaukee.
But you could never have known that all that would come when you signed on.
Never. Who'd have thunk it? Go figure that all this would be. I still get approached constantly. You know?
When that show was at its prime, you were kind of at the top of the celebrity universe. How prepared were you for that part of your life?
Well, there's no school you can go to be prepared for that. You know, you take it, you learn as you go. It's school of hard knocks, more or less. A lot of it was good, and a lot of it was, you know, trash. But I was Flavor of the Month for quite a while, and I enjoyed it. I also was the centerfold of the Inquirer for quite a while. Because anybody could say anything and allege anything, and, you know, and boom, they'd write about it.
When you are a celebrity and you are the Flavor of the Month, do you realize you're the Flavor of the Month? Or at the time, do you think, well, this is gonna last for the rest of my life?
No, you get it right away that this ain't going to last, because nothing lasts forever.
You watch the people flame out today. Do you think they don't get it?
Those that burn out like that, or they're on a fiery road, they'll either get it after they burn out, or they won't get it at all and just burn out. Of course, you could say it's a shame, it's this, it's that, but it's life. It's their life, and the only time people really get it in life is when they're in their 60s.
Which is conveniently, yes.
And that's when you say, wow, I'd like to squeeze another 25 out of this. And that's when you really get it, what's right and what's correct and how you should behave and what you should do, what you shouldn't do.
Chips has been off the air for 30 years now, and yet people still know you for that role. As you say, people still approach you. Do you think it was something about you? Do you think it was something about that show, about its time? What is it that makes it such a long-lasting kind of role for you?
So it's a bunch of things. First of all, it was three networks. It was on a Sunday night, 8 o'clock, family hour, the old-time Bonanza time slot. It was a show in which you could park your child in front of the TV and you walk away. We never drew our guns, and it was always clean. No innuendo, no alternative lifestyle things to look at. Nothing like that. And it was good. It taught respect for authority and just how to be a good guy. And also, another thing, when people see me, a lot of them realize it, but a lot of them probably subconsciously don't. But when they sat and watched Chips on Sunday night, 8 o'clock, closing the week, getting ready for the new week, they sat with the mom and dads and their brothers and sisters and you know, relatives. And they remember warm, fuzzy, cozy times. And that affects them, too. So that's one of the lasting things about it as well. And then the fact that it was the new Cowboys. It was Cowboys on motorcycles. It was the new Lone Ranger and Tonto.
What do you think of cop shows today? Because they are a much different breed than they were. Because, yeah, I remember being 8 or 9 watching Chips and not being scarred by it.
Well, yeah, because nowadays everybody is so desensitized. They have to visually have something that's sensationalistic. You got to see the gun drawn. You got to see the bullet penetrate the flesh, blow blood all over the place. When they fire at you, you just don't fall down. They want the wall behind you splattered. People are overstimulated, especially visually. In video games has done that. Spaghetti Westerns has done that. And it's just a sign of the times.
As you said, you had been acting for 7 or 8 years before you got the role on Chips. I think you grew up in Harlem, right? What drew you to acting in the first place?
Well, I wanted to be a cop. I love cops. My mom dated a cop, and I loved the guy. So I wanted to be a cop all my life. But there was a pretty girl named Christine Laporte in high school, the last couple months of high school, that I wanted to meet. And she was in drama club, and I figured, oh, man, if I want to meet her, I got to audition and get in. And I figured, hey, I grew up in the streets of New York, I can act. So I auditioned, I got in, and then I got bit by the acting bug, and I had to put the cop passion to the side.
It's kind of a happy marriage, though, that you ended up getting to be a cop. And later on, you've gotten to really do some law enforcement.
Well, I'm a real cop now. I do internet crimes against children in the state of Virginia. What's happened is that here I was a kid who wanted to be a cop because my mom dated a guy that I fell in love with, and he was a great role model. And then I wanted to be an actor. So I'm a guy that wanted to be a cop, became an actor that played a cop. Now I'm a cop that acts once in a while.
And whatever happened to Christine Laporte?
She's actually a psychic right now, very, very, very educated psychic, and lives in San Francisco.
Does she know that she had this formative role in your life?
I'm sure she's heard about it. You know, I'm sure she's heard it because I've said it and I've written about it.
As you say, you're a cop that does some acting once in a while now. A lot of your more recent roles, commercials, some reality shows have kind of – you've gently poked fun at yourself, I think. Has there been a mind shift change for you about what kinds of things you're willing to do on camera?
Well, you know, I'd like to have fun and to keep things interesting and keep myself interested and keep myself rejuvenated, I use humor because humor causes good endorphin energy to rave through your body and keep my interest in things. I use humor to just stay interested and to keep going. But of late, I was in the very faith-based movie I ever made, a movie called The Cross and the Switchblade back when 69. And I just finished two faith-based movies that we have got to try to take this culture back that we're losing. The first one is about a case we had where a girl posted a picture of herself on a smartphone. The bad guy looked at it and said, oh, I like that. That's pretty. I could sell that. And started online communication like they're doing today. And people don't realize it, but there's over 40,000 chat rooms and kids are getting taken as we speak because nobody's educating them on what not to do in these chat rooms. And they don't know how to protect themselves. And then I did a movie called Uncommon, which I'm going to take on the road next January for a year. I take it to churches and such. It's to teach our young people that they have constitutional right to express their religious beliefs. And education is the best prevention. And they're faith-based. And that's what I've been doing, and that's what I want to continue doing, as well as my police work.
Does Hollywood listen to what you have to say?
I don't talk to Hollywood. I don't do my things in Hollywood anymore. There's a lot of TV shows and stuff like that. Disney definitely has taken over Hollywood and what we see on television. But for the most part, movies are being done outside of Hollywood. First of all, we pay 52% tax. I mean, I get killed every year with taxes. And Hollywood is probably going to wake up to the fact that faith-based movies are the way to go because they're making these billion-dollar movies and they're not making the bread back. People really want to get back to to capture the culture that we're losing. Since we've taken prayer out of schools, we've got bullets now.
You are in Milwaukee, obviously, as part of the 110th anniversary of Harley-Davidson.
Right.
You spent a lot of time on camera on a bike. Do you spend time on motorcycles in your own time?
Yes, I do. I belong to two motorcycle clubs. I'm a member of the Moose Riders, Moose Lodge. I'm also Blue Knight member, motorcycle club.
You have that badge on your vest.
Badge, and then this is CHP, was given to me by the CHP. This is the wings of a motorcyclist.
For a guy that grew up in kind of tough times in Harlem, do you remember the first time? You probably wouldn't have had a lot of access to a motorcycle early on. When was the first time you got on one?
When I got chips.
I seem to remember there you were injured on a motorcycle filming Chips, right?
I had a major accident in 1980. I broke that. Look at that puppy. I broke that.
This is your right wrist for people who aren't able to see.
It's busted, and I punctured both lungs, fractured a ton of ribs, cracked my jaw, ended up in intensive care for 5 solid days.
When you look back, I imagine you probably don't watch a lot of Chips these days, but when you look back at that part of your career at the young Eric Estrada who was on Chips, is it ever surreal for you to think about what that time was like?
It was a great time. It was a great time in America. You know, it was post-Vietnam. It was disco, free live. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Long hair, bell bottoms. Cocaine was not crack, so the nines hadn't come out to the streets, the gangs. It was a great time in America. Those times will never come back. They're gone.
Do you feel like you're doing, at least in your one-person way, something to try to reclaim what was good?
No, I just want to remind people that we We have a fabulous culture in this country, and we're letting it slip away. Everybody's becoming too complacent. Complacency is taking over everybody, and look what's happening. We need to remember how good it was and how right it was.
You feel like you can capture that mindset when you're on your bike? People talk about the freedom of being on a bike.
When you're on a bike, it's a total freedom from everything except focusing on your ride. Because if you don't do that, you can get hurt.
Well, Eric Estrada, I wish you plenty of safe rides ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you, partner. Thank you very much.
Actor Eric Estrada played Ponch on the TV series Chips from 1977 to 1983. He was in Milwaukee for Harley Davidson's 110th anniversary celebration, and we spoke with him at the House of Harley dealership on Layton Avenue. There's a slideshow of the scene outside the dealership at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Earlier this week, we spoke with a House of Harley owner, John Shaler, who talked about the brand's recent efforts to reach out to women riders. Lake Effect essayist Heidi Friedrichs is already pretty comfortable on a Harley most of the time.
Wow, that's so cool. That's what I hear from onlookers when I'm riding my motorcycle. They stick their head out the car window and ask, "Does that bike go fast? Or is it fun? Or is that easy to ride?" Yes, yes, and yes. That's how it's been since I started riding over 3 years ago. Everywhere I go, it's like that. People smile at me and wave me through intersections. I gratefully acknowledge their kindness and silently thank them for not running me over. That's what I love about motorcycling. It connects people with one another through the sheer fact that we all like to play. And so, when I went to a bike show at a Harley dealership, it was with this in mind. I wanted to play with the big kids now. I still blame my sister for talking me into buying the V-Rod, but honestly, it was time for me to take it up a notch and get the right bike for me. My first motorcycle, a Sportster, was not designed for a woman of my age and, shall we say, talent for riding. Plus, it was just too damn loud, in my humble opinion. When I saw the cobalt and silver 2007 V-Rod at a dealership, I didn't even know this kind of bike existed. It was all curvy and racy and sexy. I thought, that's the bike for me. It just begs you to drape yourself over it and have your photo taken. Though clearly, I'm not really the draping type. Fast forward to the weekly bike night at the Harley-Davidson Museum. After riding down with a group of riders from the dealership, feeling all cool and confident and strong, I roamed around the grounds, made a few friends, had a beverage, got back on my bike to head home, and click, 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 nothing. I knew it was bound to end. The fantasy of being a cool, hot biker chick, it was just too good to be true. The bubble burst the moment I couldn't start my bike. Funny, the guy started drifting over little by little to offer some advice, which was super nice, and I was flattered by their sincere interest in my dilemma. Security guards, veteran bikers, older men with walking canes, even the woman who had led our ride came over to investigate the trouble. No one knew exactly, except for one guy, Tom, who owns a V-Rod. "Just walk away with your fob and come back in a half hour," he advised. Well, did I listen? No. I listened to this other guy, who clearly had a few beers in him already by this time, who slurred, "Think John Wayne. Well, I'll push you and you steer and pop the clutch." Well, since I always do what I'm told, I did what he said. But I was more worried about how ridiculous I looked on this expensive machine wobbling down the main strip than popping the clutch and throttling the bike. But I managed to do all three things at once: worry, throttle, and pop the clutch. And still nothing happened. We were the circus act that evening as everyone stood around and watched our charade, thinking only who knows what, but my guess is something along the lines of, "That chick doesn't know jack about her bike." Ah, but I do. It turns out the V-Rod has a very fancy-schmancy security system, which is very sensitive and apparently doesn't like crowds. Kind of like me. I think she was freaked out by being surrounded by so many other bigger baggers, so she pouted, flickered her warning lights, gave me the silent treatment, and stubbornly shut down. I sadly went home without my bike and embarrassed that I didn't know how to fix the problem. By then it was storming and I wouldn't have ridden home anyway. Still, bright and early next morning, after a fitful night of second-guessing myself, I returned to my bike at the museum and made nice with her, and she fired right up, of course. A little R&R was all she needed and time to cool her engines. The V-Rod is a very forgiving bike. Reminds me of a relationship I was in once. But I'll save that story for another time.
Lake Effect essayist Heidi Friedrichs writes essays and short stories about life in and around Milwaukee. She's been published on numerous websites, newspapers, and magazines in Florida and Wisconsin. That is Friday's edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by our own pack of journalists, including Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Amy Kiley, with able assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster. And this week we say a fond goodbye to Rachel Bloom, who heads back to Rhode Island after her summer with us. Keep that name in mind because we are sure you will hear it on the radio again someday. I'm Mitch Tyke. Taking us out today is the Milwaukee area jazz act called Christopher's Project with a Harley-specific tune called Let It Ride. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Let it ride on my Harley cruise.